Welcome to Let's Talk Memoir, a podcast for memoir lovers, readers, and writers. I'm your host, Ronit Plank. Welcome to season 4 of Let's Talk Memoir. I'm so happy to be back and to feature as my first guest of the season, Lisa Cooper Ellison, who specializes in helping writers work with traumatic events and getting their stories down in safe ways. This episode is chock full of resources and tools to help you as you work on some of your hardest material. Coming up in the next few months, during the spring and summer, I've got several workshop offerings that I am going to be announcing on social media, on Instagram, but also in my Memoir Moments newsletter, which you can sign up for at the link in my show notes and also find it on my website, ronitplank.com. And also, you can find this information at my new Substack under my name, Ronit Plank, and that is also going to have a Let's Talk Memoir publication. These are workshops devoted to memoir writing, and they will all have Q&A time afterwards and lots of opportunities to connect with other memoir writers and find out about my other resources. And I think that's about it. I hope you enjoy season 4. And as always, please go ahead and reach out to me, message me if you have questions that you'd like me to cover in upcoming posts or in upcoming episodes. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Today, my guest is Lisa Cooper Ellison, who is an author, speaker, and trauma-informed writing coach with an EDS in clinical mental health counseling and a background in mindfulness. She regularly presents and teaches courses on the use of mindfulness in writing, writing about trauma, the book proposal, and all things memoir. A regular contributor to the Jane Friedman blog, her essays and short stories have appeared in HuffPost, Hippocampus Literary Magazine, The New Guard Review, Canyon Review Online, and Brevity, among others. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you so much for having me, Ronit.
I'm so happy that you're here. We have got so much to cover, because we're both thoroughly in the memoir space, but we have a little bit of a different specialty and approach. And I would love for you to start by talking a little bit about your background, your sort of origin story, and how you became interested in counseling.
Yeah, you had so many great questions. So thank you so much for how thoughtfully you've put together this episode and also the other episodes that you do. I am just amazed by you. I just have to say that starting off.
Oh my gosh, coming from you and your breadth of experience, I mean, this is going to be a full-on love fest. Thank you, because I take that compliment to heart coming from you.
Well, who doesn't need a love fest, right?
Yeah, so tell us, I mean, I know that when I listen to, I should mention a little preview, we're going to also be talking about your new podcast, Writing Your Resilience, in which I really appreciated the beginning episode where you talk a little bit about your life and what brought you to this work. So if you want to give me a capsule of that, that would be great.
Yeah, so I grew up in a family that had a lot of intergenerational trauma. There was a lot of chaos, there was a lot of violence, a lot of neglect in how I grew up, and that had been passed on for generation after generation. And so internally, I often felt extremely broken and was always looking for ways to heal myself or ways to just feel like everybody else. And the one place that I could feel like everybody else and I could understand what I was feeling, which I often felt very divorced from, was when I was writing. So writing was always this huge part of who I was and how I saw the world. And I was always very psychologically minded. I don't know where that came from, but I was very curious about what other people were thinking, how things worked, and as a good little trauma survivor, I wanted to fix everyone, including myself. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons why I was so drawn to counseling. You know, I felt like, you know, I started my healing journey when I was in my 20s. I had a pretty profound, I guess we'll call it a nervous breakdown, when I was 25, and just about lost my life from it. And I started working with a counselor who was amazing. And that launched me on this journey where I began to recover who I was. And I wanted to study counseling because I wanted to give back to others this generous gift that had been given to me, and for a little while, but not by the time I got to my counseling program, but before that, I was like, and I can fix others just like I fixed myself. And so so that was a piece of how I got into the counseling program that I was in. But when I was there, the things that I learned that were so important to, I think, just being a good human and also working with other humans and being a good writer, I learned how to be very present with myself, with others, and with their stories, and to accept people where they are and to believe both in other people's autonomy. Like, you know, you have a choice as to when you heal, how you heal, what your healing looks like, but also to never lose sight of the capacity of another person to change their life.
You know, what's really interesting to me, a lot of what you're saying is where I want to dig in. But something that struck me is that you said you didn't know where this interest in psychology came from. And I'm also wondering, are you one of the few writers in your family? I mean, you know, this instinct to write, because I think a lot of writers may be some of the most curious people and introspective and reflective people in their families. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are and about writing and psychology and your family are.
You know, I think I would say I'm probably the only writer who writes for a public audience. That I can definitely say. But I come from a family of storytellers. My grandmother came from this big Italian family where people sat around the table and they told all kinds of stories. And I learned a lot of my natural storytelling skills from sitting next to her on the couch while she was crocheting. And that was a time that felt very safe and where I felt very loved. And that was really important because for my grandmother, I think that also served her really well because she was a person who experienced a lot of depression. She had agoraphobia. She didn't leave home hardly at all, like maybe once or twice a year from about the age of 54 until the rest of her life when she died when she was 91.
So the stories were sort of a way to buoy her and to maybe connect with others.
Yeah, and she had these great voices. Like, she didn't just, you know, give you information or tell you a story. She embodied her stories. And that was one of the things that made them feel magical.
Now, how did you know? So you're working as a counselor, you're helping people. How did you realize that you wanted to move into this kind of work for and with writers and devote your time to that?
That's such a great question. I always wanted to teach writing. I knew that from about the age of 25. I just knew that's what I wanted to do. But there was a part of me that felt like, oh, I don't think I'm good enough. I don't think I'm smart enough. I had all of these stories that I was telling myself. And so I was really interested in counseling, and it was such a great career move for me. I learned so much, and I loved every single client I ever worked with. But it was also the safe path. And I fully own that that was the safe path. I felt like, oh, if I do this thing, I'll have the life that I want. And then I contracted Lyme disease. And I got so sick that I had to stop working. And it was this existential crisis that I experienced. Like, who am I? What am I going to do? I actually thought I was going to die. And the way my liver was starting to shut down and other things were happening, it's very possible I could have died. And when I got to that crossroads, I began to think about what really mattered to me and what risks I would be willing to take with the rest of my life. And I thought, you know, this other career was the safe path. And what if I took a chance on myself? What if I really dedicated myself to writing, which was my dream? I mean, what do I have to lose? Because I don't even know how much time I have left. And so that served as the launching pad for me to do all of this work.
And you offer so many resources to writers. I mean, just in my own review of this, and I'm sure this is not comprehensive, it seems like you offer classes, you offer coaching, you offer like one-on-one coaching. I'm sure you're going to have to group that a lot more because you're growing in your experience and how many people want to work with you. You do classes with Jane Friedman. You also do proposals. You do so many different things when it comes to helping writers nurture their stories. And so I'd like to shift now to talking about some of what you see when you're working with writers and how listeners can start to understand the way to approach their material. So when you are working with writers, are there often similar emotional or psychological aspects of writing their stories that they need more support with?
Absolutely. And you know, that's one of the things that's been really interesting about working with writers and working with counselors is that we often think we're the only ones. And yet, the more I hear people's stories and I hear about people's struggles, I'm like, nope, we're pretty much all the same.
Right. We're not that unique, right? We're like, oh no, that person suffered this too. And this person, it manifested this way. And this is how they act in the world because of it.
Exactly. And so some of the things that I see are, you know, number one, the belief in the relevance of your story. You know, does my story matter? Is this something that I should be working on? And what I always tell people is if you're called to do it, some part of your soul is saying there is a growth edge here and embrace it. That doesn't necessarily mean it's for a public audience, but there's something there to learn and grow from. And so that belief, It shows up in the beginning and it can show up all the way through, especially when we start feeling a lot of the doubts that happen in the middle of the process when, you know, you're just starting to really crack open your story, which is the point where you're like, I thought I knew what this meant, but I have no clue what this actually means. And you're trying to piece things back together. The issue of feeling safe when you're writing, you know, I work with a lot of people who've experienced really tough things in their lives. They're trying to tell very tough stories. And there can be a lot of healing that happens when we do this, but we have to take care of our nervous systems. It's so, so, so important. And so teaching people how to write in a way that doesn't overly activate your nervous system, like there's no way to not activate your nervous system and feel if you are writing well. It's just part of the process. But you don't want it to be beyond your threshold of tolerance. And you don't always want to be revising a story that is, this is what happened to me and this is how I hurt. Like you absolutely have to start there. But if that's the only story that you tell, you are reinforcing a victim narrative inside yourself. And that does not serve you. And it also does not serve your reader.
So that there's a lot there. And I guess I want to begin by saying, how can a writer know that the charged material they're working on is tough, but that they can handle it, and material that might still be too raw or traumatic to begin tackling?
Great question. And it's all going to come down to the body. And what I want to start with is to talk about, I would say, the polarities of experiences that people have if they have experienced a lot of trauma, and especially if they have complex trauma. So people who are trauma survivors often live on the edges of experience. So some people really avoid feelings, they avoid intense experiences. These people are probably not going to be writers. But then there are other people who thrive on intensity and thrive on, you know, going to the deepest, darkest, most painful place ever. And so when you live on one of those poles, your goal is to get back to the middle. And so some signals that people have that they're at the pole is what's happening in your body. Like a lot of trauma survivors have incredible grit and they can make themselves sit down and write things that are absolutely powerful and poignant and painful and disturbing and jarring. But what's happening to your body? You know, are you experiencing shakes? Does your stomach hurt? Does it feel like your jaw's about to break? Or afterwards, are you having nightmares? Do you have trouble transitioning to whatever you're supposed to do next? Do you keep thinking about that experience over and over and over again? If you are having those kinds of experiences, it's likely that this material belongs in therapy. And so I often tell people, you know, if you want a good litmus test, before you begin writing, scale what you want to write about on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is like a fly buzzing by. You're probably not even going to write about it because it doesn't matter. A 10 is the worst thing that ever happened to you. And don't think about the content, like, because sometimes someone else will say like, oh my gosh, that's the worst thing. And you're like, that didn't seem that bad to me. But it's how does this feel? So you want to think about that and then think about your energy. on a similar scale of one being like, I can't get out of bed, and 10 being, I have so much energy, I don't know what to do with it. And really trying to find stuff that's in that 3 to 7 range where, you know, in terms of the writing, it activates you, there's emotions, you don't know what something means, you have a lot of motivation to figure that out. But in terms of your energy, you also have some extra energy to be able to expend on that. Because when you're writing tough stories, it is always going to expend energy. And mm-hmm. so for some people, they feel like, oh my gosh, I just did this writing session. I feel like I just ran a marathon. And that's because part of your nervous system did.
Mm-hmm. And you said that if it's really tough material, really, really tough, and all those physiological symptoms are in action, that belongs in therapy. And is the idea then that maybe one day you would be able to write about it, but right now you don't need to do that alone on the page?
Absolutely. And you may find that you write with your therapist so that you have someone who is bearing witness to your experience. You know, one of the things that can happen that re-traumatizes someone is that they try to white knuckle their way through a draft because they believe that's what writers have to do, or this is what it means to be successful. But when people experience trauma, they often experience it alone, and there is some element of force involved. Either you are forced to do something that you don't want to do, or you do not have access to the things you need. And so when you force yourself to write, especially if you're having any of those physiological symptoms, or you know, you're having this inner resistance to get to the page, like maybe a part of you saying like, no, maybe not this, maybe not now, but you're ignoring it, you actually run the risk of re-traumatizing yourself. And that can give you writer's block and make you hate writing.
Mm-hmm. Right, because it's a dangerous place. It's uncertain and there's no safety net.
Exactly.
So if you decide, let's say you're in the 3 to 7 range as a writer, the material that you're going to approach, but it's still tough and it still exacts a toll, what are other ways that you can take care of yourself while you're writing in terms of maybe time limits or environment or any kind of other support that you can give yourself while you're working on that material?
Absolutely. And so I think one of the first things that you want to do is develop a robust self-care practice. So self-care is something proactive that you do in advance. It's not comfort where you're like, oh, I'm really depleted right now, I think I need some self-care. No, self-care is what you do in advance. And you want to care for your body through getting adequate sleep, good food, movement. You want to care for your mind by taking breaks, finding things that inspire you, looking for things that are positive, being with your emotions, no matter what they are. And you also want to do things that are helping support your nervous system. And that could be taking a lot of deep breaths, like having a practice of that throughout the day. It could be humming, it could be walking in nature. There's lots of different things you want to do. And the reason you want to develop that practice in advance is because then it will be automatic that you will do these things when things get tough. You also mm-hmm. want to make sure that you have support, which can include a therapist, mentors, mentees, people who are going to cheer you on, and to let yourself know that it's just going to take time and to be really patient. So this mm-hmm. is some of the stuff you want to begin to develop. And if you're like, but Lisa, I'm already writing, are you telling me I have to quit writing? You do not. But begin to develop these strategies and these practices around your writing. And then when you're writing, and this is something that came from the work that James Pennebaker did. So he wrote this book, Writing to Heal, and his work is quoted a lot. And so I'm not going to quote it because I have some feelings about it, which we won't get into today, but another time, Ronit, if you want to get into it.
Oh, no, now I definitely have to will. Know, but okay, cliffhanger.
I love him, but I think that sometimes people think that he writes a lot about if you write, you're always going to feel better, and that's not always the case. And I think that is not about a flaw in his work. It's a misuse of his work, so we'll just kind of leave it at there. Mm-hmm. But you know, this idea of setting time limits. So in your writing week, think about how much time you have. If you have really tough stuff, anything that's a 7 and Y'all, I already know you're going to go with an 8 or a 9 because I'm human. I've done that too. You want to make sure that you are stopping within 20 minutes. So I always tell people, establish a ritual in advance that calms your nervous system. Meditation can be a great way to do that. Going for a walk, drinking, you know, a hot drink. So do that in advance. And then if it's really tough stuff, contact somebody else and say, hey, I'm getting ready to do this work. You don't even have to tell them what it is, but it should be a writing buddy who can be like, I got your back. So you tell that person, you do the writing, you set a timer for 20 minutes. And if you're feeling all right, you can go on for another, say, 10, 15 minutes, but you need to be wrapping up by that point because you do not need to train your nervous system to stay in a highly activated state. And I think that's so important because a lot of trauma survivors, and I'm raising my hand here, even though y'all can't see me, I feel that I love to live in activation. Like my nervous system feels like that is totally normal. Mm-hmm. And I have to constantly be vigilant about doing the opposite. So you want to pause, stop, and then you want to do something that allows you to re-enter your day. And that is something that allows you to end. So I think it was Ernest Hemingway. He used to write down what he was going to do next at the end. So that way you're not thinking about it. You don't have to ruminate. You know where you're going. You can let it go. Maybe go for a walk. You can do a dance. You can shake it out. And then connect with someone else. Mm-hmm. That and tell them what your plan is for the rest of the day. That way you have accountability to getting back to your day. Because what can happen is you're like, yeah, sure, Lisa, I'm going to do all those things. And then you do it on your own. And because you didn't tell anyone else, you're like, but I'm going to still keep thinking about this. Because your brain will want to. So you want to be really intentional about that. And then do something supportive for yourself. And if you are writing about really intense stuff, you're going to need time to rest afterwards. So if you know you have a busy day, you want to write for 20 minutes and then allow 20 minutes for stillness.
I really appreciate this because I think when I was writing my memoir, I don't know that I did this. I don't know that I actually created those buffering elements, this kind of support. And I do agree with you. I think that maybe what you're saying is that people who have gone through trauma are so tough in many cases and have so much grit because of what they've survived that there is a tendency maybe in some of us to just push because we can take it and why not? And, you know, who are we to need extra help or support perhaps? And not all of us, I'm just saying I can see that in myself. And so to take care of ourselves while we're doing this hard work, we deserve that.
Absolutely. We do. Yeah. And one thing that I learned recently, and I learned this from a somatic processing book by Peter Levine, and it has all of these different strategies in it. And one of the things he talks about is how in nature, animals are generally not trauma survivors, or you know, they have traumatic experiences or things that are scary happen and they literally shake it off. So if you're writing about something or you even experience something that triggers old trauma or feels traumatic and you start shivering, let your body do it. Because when you do, you are allowing whatever that experience is to shake out of you.
That's so funny because when I think about what we learned, this is, forgive me, but my reference point here is when we went to puppy training class and they would have sort of like an adrenaline shake, the puppies, like I forgot the actual term, but if you have dogs, you know what I'm talking about, where they just kind of like bristle and shake because it's just like, whoa, that was a lot. So it's okay to do that. Like as a writer, you can do that.
Do the puppy shake.
Yeah. So I'd love to talk about memory and memoir for a second. It's one of my favorite subjects. And in fact, on season one, I had Dr. Virginia Campbell as my guest, and we had an episode entitled Memory, Truth, and Memoir, which is a very popular episode because it talks about this idea of our memories and what is actually true, what happened, and do we have the right to talk about it? And I have a lot of opinions on this. And I would love you to reflect on the science of memories and how we use them in memoir and what happens when we write and rewrite our story.
Yeah, this is a great question. And I also love memory. And I think it's because in my case, I remember back to about 18 months for whatever reason. I have like very specific memories that are independent of other people in my family. They're not things that people told me. And I've always wondered, like, how is that, or why is that, and how does all of this work? Because one of the things I've learned is, like, I have a very vivid memory. And yet, as I was writing my memoir, there were times where I would swear certain things happened a certain way, and they did not. So let's talk a little bit about memory. So when you have an experience, like, we have experiences all day long. That's just part of life, right? But when you have an experience that you are either rehearsing, like you're trying to learn something, so you go over it in your mind again and again, or that experience is tied to a strong emotion, and that could be a positive emotion or a negative emotion, it doesn't matter, but the intensity of the emotion, your brain says, this is important. And especially if it's tied to something related to survival, your brain's going to say it's really important, and it gets encoded into long-term memory. But what gets encoded is going to be dependent upon how you're feeling and your perspective. So you're not going to get everything. So that means that every memory has some aspect that's incomplete. You know, in the sense that you don't have an all-seeing eye that sees every single thing that happens, and you do not record every single thing that happens. You record what is related to your survival and how you're feeling. So that's how you attach a certain kind of meaning to it. And every single time you bring that memory up, it changes just a little, right? Because you're going to bring in some new thing. Like if you are thinking about something and you have a different emotion, you know, maybe the first time you were thinking about this birthday party, you were like, yeah, best birthday party ever. And then you learned, oh my gosh, and this terrible thing happened in the middle of the birthday party. Maybe you have hurt feelings now. Something else is coloring the memory you have. And so that changes it just a little bit. And so memories are very malleable. And so we can't rely on capital T truth to come out of memories, but that does not mean your memory is not true. And I think this is really important for people who came from invalidating environments or where they had narcissism in their family and they were told things like, you know, what you thought happened didn't happen, quit over dramatizing, and, you know, somebody else was trying to control how you thought or felt about an experience. So whatever you think or feel is real and it is true. And you do not have to deny that. But mm-hmm. as you begin to work with your memories, and they change because the brain is very plastic. So neuroplasticity is how the brain changes and the neuron clusters change. And it's very exciting to learn about how all that happens. But as you do that, you begin to develop more context, a different perspective. You include new details, and what happens is that you establish new meaning around your experiences. And this is one of the reasons why writing can be so powerful, because it allows you to do that work. And as you create new meaning, this doesn't mean that if somebody did something that was really hurtful, you're going to suddenly be like, oh, but now that I have perspective, it's all okay. Like, right? No, it can still be hurtful, but you have a greater context around it, and the emotional intensity that you associate with that memory is going to be different. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest lessons that I learned from doing this work, and I have watched many of my clients and students also come to this conclusion, is that it's not about you. A lot of the hurtful things that other people do are related to them operating from a place of pain and trying to get their needs met in a way that's not great and is hurtful. Mm-hmm. But that hurt isn't, you know, some maniacal, awful desire to harm you, like to ruin your life. They're often not even thinking about you. They're just thinking about, I want what I want and I need what I need and I don't want to feel this thing, so I'm just going to react.
Mm-hmm. Right. And of course, people they do such damage to growing bodies and minds. So it can hurt anyone when people act like that out of pain. But of course, yes. The people who are acting out of pain are raising children or caregiving vulnerable people. They make a lasting impression. They change the way those young people grow up.
Absolutely. And I'm reading this book right now by Nicole LaPera. So if you want to learn who she is, check her out on Instagram. That's probably the best place to find her. But it's Becoming the Love You Seek. And she talks a lot about having self-compassion for yourself as a parent, because the job is enormous. And if you don't have everything you need, you are not likely to be able to give that to your children. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that you can come in with all the love in the world, and if you don't have what you need and that spills over on other people, yes, it can cause great harm. And another great book, What Happened to Me by Dr. Bruce Perry and Oprah Winfrey, really outlines how this works and how just those first few weeks and first few months have such a powerful impact on our nervous systems and how we operate throughout the rest of our lives. Like, talk about pressure.
Oh, I was just going to say that. I mean, I know about the influence that parents and caregivers in those early weeks have, and how malleable, we're so malleable as babies, which is amazing, but also so frightening, the power that people who take care of us have. I mean, it kind of stops me in my tracks when I think about exactly how much impact bad behavior and cruelty can have on any growing person. And in a way, I wish we could evolve as humans to have a little bit more protection, because so many caregivers are not prepared to take care of little ones, you know, in a way that is going to help and nurture them. It's awful.
Absolutely. We don't have a village. We don't have a village anymore. A lot of parents are doing this alone, and the more isolated a family is, the higher the chances for abuse, especially if you have stressed caregivers.
Mm. Right. And who doesn't? I mean, we all are, and we can have the best intentions, but it shows you, I think about a lot, like how many things can go wrong in terms of boundaries and narcissism and cruelty and responsibility. So many things can go wrong. And I mean, we could talk about that for a whole nother episode. There's also a variety of aspects of writing memoir and resilience that you teach in your classes. And there's so much that you offer. I'm only going to be able to just touch on it briefly here, but something that you teach, which I want to know more about, is the stages of change. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so the stages of change, or I'm going to get all fancy here, the trans theoretical model of change, which is something that I learned in graduate school when I was taking a class on treating people who had addiction. So that's where it comes from, is addiction studies. And it's a framework for thinking about how change happens. And so there are different stages. So in pre-contemplation, you don't even realize you have a problem. Things may be happening to you, but you're like, eh, it's somebody else's deal. Something else is going on. It's not me. And so you're not willing to address it. And then you get to contemplation where you think, oh, maybe I do have a problem or something's going on that I need to address. That gets to a decision point, action. You're like, I'm going to do something about this. So a book that I really like, Stash by Laura Cathcart Robbins, which is a recovery memoir.
Oh, yes. She was a guest as well. Laura was a guest.
Yes. I love Laura. And I love her podcast, too. I love your podcast, which everyone should be listening to. But yeah, she's great. And so, you know, an example would be the point when she decided, I have to go to rehab, which is a big part of her book. That would be a point of action. But I'm going to back up. Even before that, though, so we decide we have a problem, then we start planning. We don't necessarily act right away, but we decide we're going to do it. We make some plans, then we act. But just acting doesn't mean things are going to change. We're going to have obstacles, and those are our relapses, times when we backslide, times when things get in our way. And then, you know, we get to a maintenance phase where we pretty much figured it out enough that life is okay. Doesn't mean we have it all figured out, but we figured it out enough, and then things terminate or we have an ending. Mm-hmm. If you look at how change is happening inside you from this lens, you can use it to figure out your narrative arc.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So you're kind of plotting your story based on the changes within you and making it a narrative, like a narrative arc.
Yes. And this is just one of, I mean, I have a number of different ways that I teach
Yeah.
people how to do this, but I find that this is really helpful because what can happen when we have really interesting experiences or powerful experiences or both is that we can write about one experience and then we write about the next one and the next one. And so, early drafts of our memoir can look like this happened and then this happened and then this happened. And each individual item is exciting and interesting and well written on its own, but it doesn't come together to create this cohesive whole.
Right. It's not actually, it doesn't have a lot of forward momentum, I think. I think that it can just be
Exactly.
a list of things, basically, a bunch of things that happened, but there's no sort of higher consciousness organizing it or showing the reader what to make of that.
Yes. And early drafts often involve a lot of action, like this happened, right? So it's a thing that happened outside. And so this is an opportunity for you to step back and say, okay, well, where was I in this process? What was happening inside me? And how did that change? And what I like about this is that it puts you in the driver's seat, because especially for people who are writing really tough stories, a lot of the early drafts are, this is what happened to me, which puts you in a victim role. And I don't mean that in a negative way. It's just that's a place of powerlessness. And so when you're thinking about where was I in the change process? Did I recognize that something was happening that I needed to change? Did I do this? Did I do that? It puts you in the role of the hero, which allows you to create forward momentum in your book.
Yes, and I love this, and this happened to me as well, briefly when I was drafting for my thesis, my memoir back at Pacific University. Deborah Gortney was my teacher, and I remember her saying, and mine is a coming of age memoir, and I remember her saying, "But what part did you play in this?" And I remember thinking, "How can you ask me that in my earlier days there? How my parents left, each of my parents left, my mom followed a guru. How can you say what my part was in this? That doesn't make sense to me." But what she was referring to, in brief, was my pattern and what was happening for me and what I understood about my life and who I was because of this. And so, though my parents left, I had to come to a place of telling my story as it related to my growth and what I did with my circumstances. And that was my journey. And so, I totally understand what you're talking about. But I think when you're beginning your draft, like you said, it's great. Just get all that information down, get everything that happened down if you want. Later on, you kind of have to make meaning from it because it's not about what happened, it's about what you make of what happened.
Absolutely. And if you are writing especially a coming of age, memoir where you're like, well, what role did a 4-year-old play in all of this? Well, the role you played is that you may have developed some misbeliefs about how the world worked. And often, what changes in memoir is what we believe or how we see things. So I think Marion Roach Smith talks about it in this way. It's about what we know after what we've gone through. So that's what changes is what we know or what we believe or think or feel.
I love that. That's the first time I've heard it put that way, and that's very helpful. So before I pivot to talking about your new podcast, I wanted to ask you, it's one of the things you cover in one of your classes, but I'm so intrigued by this question, and I want to know what you think about this. So what does it mean if beta readers or critique partners ask for more of you on the page, but there's no more of you to give?
Oh, yes. I know this question well. I have faced this question myself. That's, a lot of the things that I teach are because I struggled. And that's one of the things I love. And this is a big struggle for me. And I think it's a big struggle for a lot of trauma survivors. So what that means, if people are asking for more and you're saying there ain't no more, is that there's a gap. And I learned this wonderful word recently from reading Sue Williams Silverman's new book, Acetylene Torch Songs, and that is the word lacunae, which is a word for a gap, and it could be a gap in memory. And so it may be that you need to, there may be a gap in either your memory, what you remember, or what you understand, and that's the piece that needs to be added. And so maybe you need to do some research, go back and look at your journals, interview other people. There could be certain things like that you need to do. But what often happens is there is a gap between what readers expect to see in terms of your feelings, on the page and how you felt. So either the feelings are missing or you have a lot of, and I felt nothing again. Which, you know, for trauma survivors, if you're talking about a real high intensity moment where you felt like you just had to survive, you probably didn't feel anything because you had to shut your emotions down and often dissociate in order to survive the situation. So I've talked to many people who are like, were you just surviving? Were you just surviving? And they're like, yes. So what do you do? That's the question. What do you do with that? So, you know, metaphor could be one way that you look at it. So really thinking about how could I use metaphor to illustrate what else I might have been feeling. Or you can also use speculation. Had I been in my body, I might have felt this, 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 and this. Or sometimes, you know, metaphor or speculation are not useful for the type of story you're telling or that particular situation. And so what you might want to do is investigate on your own, how, if I think about this situation now, how do I feel? Because how you feel now is likely how you felt then, or how you would have felt had you had permission to feel. Another thing you can do is investigate, what do other people feel when these kinds of things happen? And you can own the fact that you didn't feel, and also say, and also talk about what the general feelings are, because that's meeting a reader's needs. And so one of the things that I find is sometimes a struggle for people is like, they're like, but this is how it happened. But this is how it happened. It's my story. And hell yeah, it's your story when you first start working on it. But when you go, if this is a story for public consumption, this is going to be published. Eventually, it is not a story for you. It is a story for a reader, and you have to be able to address the reader's needs. And one of the reader's needs is to figure out how to deal with their own difficult emotions. So you have to be able to mirror that for them.
I love the idea of speculating. And I also really encourage writers to call out what's going on for them. It's okay to say, this is really frustrating to write. I mean, you might shape it and hone it later, right? But the idea of really calling out what's happening, because it really makes you more alive on the page. And I think readers are so smart, especially memoir readers. We have hunches and we're really interested in psychology and we're understanding subtext and what people want and what they're not saying. And so I think we intuit that something is at stake for the memoirist, even if they're not saying it. And so you have to say it. You have to call it out.
And I think Roxane Gay does this really well in her book, Hunger. You know, she says, I don't want to talk about it. And I think sometimes just admitting, like, I don't want to talk about it, or there are no words for this thing, can be the entry point for figuring out how you want to talk about whatever that tough thing is, whether it's an emotion you don't have access to, an experience that feels like it defies language, whatever that is. I think that's a great way to do it. Call it out. I love that.
Right? Yes. And you just come from a place of you welcome that part of you in, and you allow the reader to see that part of you. And then you can always eliminate that first sentence or two and just leave what you have created on the page, or you can keep it. So let's talk about your new podcast in our final few minutes. You've just launched a podcast, Writing Your Resilience. And when this episode airs, you'll have a few out already. So how did you know? Tell me what the show is about and how you knew it was time to launch it.
Yeah, so Writing Your Resilience is a podcast for anyone who wants to use the writing process to make new meaning from their lives. So a lot of the people that will probably benefit from this are memoirists, but you could be writing for yourself. And the reason I knew I needed to do this is because we all have author platforms that we have to be working on and expanding. And there was a point in time when people said, Lisa, you should create a podcast. And I was like, no, I don't need to create a podcast. It was all about fear, right? I was afraid I couldn't do it, that it was going to be too much work. And you know, Renit, it is a lot of work.
Right? What are you talking about? Of course.
Yeah, but I didn't think I could do it. And then I checked in with myself. I did a lot of work on that last year of, you know, what is authentic to me? Who am I and what gifts do I bring? And I actually asked clients, students, I think I asked people in my newsletter, Why do you stick with me? Why do you hire me? What is it that I do that you feel like is my gift? And people gave me a lot of information that was really helpful. And a couple of things they said is, you make me feel safe. You make this process feel safe. You inspire me. And part of the ways that I did that was, these strategies I teach and, and the way I hold space for people, but also because I show up as a person who struggles alongside them. And so when I knew, when I got really clear about that, I said, okay, where can I do this best? And I just had this inner knowing in my body, like, it's time to start a podcast. And you need to focus on resilience because that's how you show up in the world. And this is the gift that you can give to others. And I wanted to do three things. One, I ran away from home when I was 16, and then I finally left when I was 17, and I wanted to write then, and I didn't have a dime to my name. And I want to make sure for anyone who wants to write that they have access to strategies. It's very important to me. I also believe in supporting other writers and lifting up other voices. And I also believe in being authentic and having real conversations with people, which, I do a little of that on social media, but not as much as I would like. And I thought, this is an opportunity to do all three.
And you've got some great subjects that you're covering. I've already looked at the lineup and I know that we did an interview and I'm super excited about that. What you're doing today on my show is going to be even more on your show. All these tips and these topics that we're diving into, you're going to go even deeper. So it's such a resource and I'm grateful that you're doing this work. So thank you for doing that because I know how much time it takes.
Well, thank you. And I'm really excited because what I wanted to do was bring great writers, really astute psychiatrists, psychologists, people in the mental health field, and people who have tough stories together so that it's not just one thing. We're looking at resilience from many different angles. And oh my gosh, I've already recorded the first season. I wanted to make sure I had that done before I launched. So many great conversations. I cannot wait to share it with everybody.
Me too. And you have mentioned a couple of books so far, which I will put in the show notes. Are there any other memoirs that you want to recommend or that inspired you early on, or books that you hold dear that you would like to share with listeners?
So that list is long. And
I know it probably is really, really long.
yes,
Yes.
always. And what I'll talk about is the first book that made memoir come alive for me. I think that's probably the best way. And then I could give you a thousand different books that also were helpful to me. And it was Another Bullshit Night in Suck City. I lost my brother to suicide in 1997. And in 2000, I was in a writing class and I discovered this book. And it was the first time that I read a memoir by a survivor of suicide loss. And there was something about the way Nick Flynn told his story that felt like he was telling my story, and I felt seen. And when I read that, I said, I want to do this too. And it took many years before I got to a point where I could actually do that, especially with that topic. But I would say that's one on my bookshelf that I hold dear because it was part of my awakening to the power of this genre.
Thank you. And I'll add, if you want to send me a few more, that's great. I can add them. Okay, so I guess we're at the end of our time together. Where can people find you and your show and your classes and all the things that you're doing?
So the best way to find me is to go to my website, lisacooperellison.com, and you can sign up for my newsletter. My newsletter is not even just a newsletter, it is a community experience. So when people are part of my community, you get opportunities to share your publications with the community. You can answer questions for the community. You share your milestones. And everybody who signs up for the newsletter gets access to Write More, Fret Less, which is an ebook that I created that has five brain hacks that will supercharge your writing life. So that's probably the best. If you want to find me on social media, I'm at Lisa Cooper Ellison. This will show up in the show notes and at Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And also, I'm on LinkedIn sometimes, and that is Lisa Cooper Ellison, but there's like a B543, like other things attached to that. So I'm just going to give you the link, Ronit.
Okay, that sounds great. Well, I know that we could talk forever, and one day, hopefully, we'll meet in person and we can do that. I am so, so happy that we had this time together and really, really excited for your show and all of the good work you're doing. So thank you very much, Lisa.
Well, thank you, Ronit, for everything you do for the writing community, and thank you so much for having me on your show.
Thank you for tuning in to Let's Talk Memoir. For more about this episode and my guest, please visit the link in the show notes or on Instagram at Ronit Plank. That's RonitPlank. You can also follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok. If you liked this episode of Let's Talk Memoir, please go ahead and share it with your friends and subscribe. And if you have 2 more seconds, you can rate and review it on Apple Podcasts, which really does help other people find the show. Thank you so much for being here.